Thank you. So the talk is about limitations, but since I don't assume any knowledge about big data, I first want to try to give the hype as well. I personally am very enthusiastic about big data. My background is in statistics. I work in analytic marketing applications. So this is a very natural area for me. This is an area of my research. So the reason I spend so much time on it is because I do think it is has a lot of promise and we can solve problems. But at the same time, we also have limitations. And as with anything, there is this hype, there's the reality. So I wanted to spend a little time talking about what I think is the reality and what the expectation should be about big data. The way that I'm going to do this is that I've picked out three short case studies. So roughly we'll spend maybe half our time talking about the promise and then the other half the time talking about the case studies. And then again, I'd like to make some remarks about what I see as the lessons from these case studies. So two of these are my research. The other is just an example that I picked up because I think it's a nice one, both in trying to illustrate the benefits as well as perhaps the hazards of big data. I would also say that if you would like to get a copy of the slides, if you email me at alanmontgomery@cmu.edu, I would be happy to send you a file. Alright, so the place to start is the promise of big data. So big data has been around for a number of years. If you go back, it's probably been popular as a term for about 5 years. Anywhere you turn, it seems that big data is on the cover and there's this promise about what big data is going to do for us. So I don't know if you can read some of the titles, but they're actually pretty edifying and interesting in themselves. The Economist in 2010 has the data deluge. Its businesses, governments, and society are only starting to tap its vast potential. In the Popular Science, the tagline is "Data is power, how information is driving the future." The tagline on the articles were "The glory of big data, suddenly we can know the world completely, next we can program it." The Harvard Business School, so again to get a variety of both business and science as well as academic publications, had a cover in 2012 on getting control of big data. Big data, the management revolution, to repeat the benefits of big data, you may have to change your company's decision-making culture. There was an article in Nature. You can see that this is an old article because this was science in the petabyte era, which was 3-4 years ago. So already we're thinking about exabytes and yettabytes and zettabytes, and we're beyond petabytes anymore. As you look at these, the common thing amongst all these is that there's a huge amount of promise of what big data is. Big data sounds actually quite sexy, or at least it's made out to be. And I think one of the reasons is that it's not well defined. So when I talk to a lot of business people and they're thinking about big data, their expectation is that big data is going to help me to solve really complex problems. So their expectation is that any problem they don't know how to solve right now, that's what big data is going to allow them to solve. So I hate to say, but right up front, that's wrong. Right? What is big data? So let me try to attempt what I would define as big data. I think there are four basic tenets or components that we want to put in a definition of big data. So we have data and we have big, and most people just focus on big. So what is big? Well, it's massive data sets. And again, one of the reasons that big data is unique from regular data is that these massive data sets usually are going to be at the enterprise level. So we're talking about not a data set that I can download onto a hard drive, not something that is a gigabyte or even a terabyte, but we're possibly talking about things that are going to be thousands or millions or even trillions of gigabytes. So that's a very taxing structure, and we have to start thinking about how are we going to build computers that are going to allow us to analyze this data. However, I still think of massive data as things that have millions of records. To me, that's still a large data set. Maybe not a massive data set, but it's still large. And I should point out that once you start crossing the boundary into those millions of gigabytes, then all of a sudden, even simple tasks can be very complex if we do that in the usual way. So if I want to just compute an average of numbers, and I have to read through from a hard drive or a distributed hard drive, it's going to take a lot of time. All right, so clearly, big data is a massive data set. The second thing is that it's unstructured data. So what is the difference between structured and unstructured? Well, structured is where I can go back and I can have an SQL query. I have a nice table. The table has rows and columns. The columns are going to be well-defined. I'll have things like numbers. I can validate the numbers. I know the numbers are going to go between this and this level. This is unstructured data. So what might happen is I've got a lot of textual information. It's free format. It could be XML. It could be graphical in nature. It could be video. It could be a combination of all these things. So what happens is that it's easy to store data or save data, so we'll just save everything, and that leads to have a very unstructured environment, which is one of the reasons that big data is especially difficult to work with. So again, it's massive, it's unstructured, and then the last couple are going to be more important as you start thinking about business applications and from a research standpoint. It's collected as a byproduct from transactions. So the reason that we go about collecting big data is not because I've signed up a lot of customers and said, we want to start doing experiments and collecting information from you. The reason that you're on Facebook is not so Facebook can collect societal information. It's because I want to share information with my friends and my colleagues. All right, so what we usually think of big data, since it is a byproduct, we have all kinds of host of privacy issues that are going to be associated with it. I'm not going to talk about privacy. I'm just going to think about what are the limitations from the research side and not trying to get into public policy questions today. Then the other, if you're a statistician, is that this data set is the complete population. It's not a sample. As a statistician, I was trained to think about how do we experiment and how do we take a little data set to try to figure out what a larger data set is. So I can't interview every customer that I have. I might have thousands or millions of customers. So what I tend to do is I randomly sample 30 or 50 or 100, and then from that I make inferences about what the population looks like. Well, that's no longer true. In big data, I get to see everybody. I don't have to just worry about talking with a small number of people. I'm going to see a huge number. I'm going to see everybody. All right, so that changes your thinking about how you're going to go back and start thinking about big data. Again, I can contrast this with some of the other definitions. Oftentimes, people cite the three V's, which are going to things to be like velocity, volume, and variety. And they map into what I would put as the basic components of big data, so it's not that different. Some people go further, and they start talking about the veracity and the validity and also the volatility of data. So they want to add three more V's, and sometimes they even want to add three U's, which are the unknowns, the uncertainty, and the unfamiliarity. So again, computer scientists tend to think in terms of algorithms that are needed to extract information from the data. Business tends to be very decision-oriented, so the focus is going to be on making decisions from the knowledge that's derived, and we need to contrast that with decisions that we would make without big data. So whatever the difference is between what we were doing before and what we're doing with big data, that's how I start thinking about what the value of big data is going to be. And again, the value changes. So along with big data, there are all kinds of other things that are related to this. There's data science, which is in vogue right now, is a new title. So to me, data science means that I'm going to take the core disciplines of statistics and computer science in an applied area, in this case, business, and I'm going to look at that intersection, and that's going to lead me to data science. That's also going to be similar to business analytics. I need to know something about data analysis. I need to know algorithms for data mining, machine learning, and statistics to try to represent models and extract information. All right, so this is what I think of as big data. So as I go back and say big data, these are the things that I have in mind in... Where does big data come from? And again, this comes back to a very interesting component, which is most of the time it's a byproduct of what consumers are doing. I walk into Walmart, and what happens? Well, I go through the aisles, I collect my basket, at the end I present my credit card or my cash, and I have a receipt. So I've got a set of items. So why is this interesting? Well, what makes this interesting is that Walmart handles more than 1 million customer transactions every hour. So if I multiply that out times 24 times 365 days, it turns out that this is going to be a really big data set. So again, I as a consumer was not really thinking about giving this information to Walmart, but Walmart is going to study trends and patterns to try to figure out what do I buy, when do I buy it, and what do I not buy. And if the price is too high, do I not buy it? Facebook is another one of those examples. And again, it's a very rich environment. They have 50 billion photos from its user base. So now we have machine learning techniques where we can scan photos, start recognizing people. Just think about the kinds of things that I can learn from photos if I could actually scan and recognize. I could tell who is in the photo. I could tell what I'm doing. I can tell where I'm at. Sometimes I can find things that are encoded in the metadata from these photos. Other times I'm just going to, again, try to look at the context of the photos. So besides that, there's 30 petabytes of user-generated data that Facebook has access to. eBay, any retailer, they have two data warehouses at 7.5 petabytes each. So they've got Hadoop clusters. They've got all kinds of merchandising information, not just about their customers, but about the merchants that are part of the system. There's Twitter. So over here, some innocuous comment like, OMG, church was freaking awesome this morning. So if you start taking a look at millions or billions of these tweets, all of a sudden you start finding a lot of information about consumers. So there are 277,000 tweets that are published any given minute in Twitter. So again, as you start multiplying this out, you realize, wow, that's billions of messages that we're seeing. Here's an example of Google. Obviously, I search on Google all the time. Google had 9,800 searches in 1998. Last year, they were at 2.6 trillion, 2.2 trillion, or roughly $6 billion per day, which was up from $5 billion per day in 2012. So again, you can see there's a huge amount of growth. many consumers, the first time they start thinking about something, they go to Google and they search for it. So I think about a trip that I'm going to take. I think about a product that I'm going to purchase. I think about an ailment that I have. So I go to Google, I search for it. So Google now has a very intimate knowledge of what you're thinking. Finally, I have Waze. So this is an Israeli company that was recently purchased by Google. The idea is that I could have smartphones that are tracking movements. So let me use these GPS-enabled devices so I can get a sense of where people are at. How fast are they moving? So if I see people sitting in the freeway and they're going 2 kilometers per hour or 20 or 100, I can give some sense of what's a good route and what's a bad route. Right. So just to give you a sense of just taking all these disparate pieces of information and start putting them together. Well, there are 2.4 billion people that are enabled on the internet. There are 9 billion devices. So clearly, many people are overrepresented. So I've got a laptop, and I have an iPad, and I have a smartphone, and I have a computer, a workstation. So every minute, Google has 4 million searches. Facebook has 2.5 million pieces of content being shared. Tinder has 400,000 user swipes. WhatsApp is 347,000 photos. Twitter has 277,000 tweets. Instagram has 216,000 new photos. Amazon makes $83,000 in online sales. Again, this is every minute. Pandora has 61,000 of hours of music that's being listened to in that one in moment. Apple has 48,000 apps that are downloaded. Skype has 23,000 hours of connections or content that's being transferred. Pinterest has 3,500 images. YouTube users upload 72 hours, and email users send 204 million messages. All right, so again, to get a better sense of scale, multiply everything times 1440 to get it per minute, or multiply it times another 365 to try to get an idea of what this looks like per year. All right, so however you want to measure it, the point is that we're inundated with data. Data's all around us. So what do we know? Data is a competitive advantage. McKinsey did this study where they went back and they look at what are the companies that are using big data and what are the companies that are not using big data. Who are the big data retailers? So in grocery, they went back and they looked at profitability and they found out the profitability is twice as high for those with big data. In online retail, it's 24% versus minus 1%. If you're not using big data in online retail, that means that you're not making any money. Big box retail, 9% versus 5%. Casinos, 11 versus 5%. Credit cards, 14% versus 9%. Insurance, 9% versus 8%. All right, so difficult as it may be, effectively managing big data can help your company generate more money than its competitors. Right, so again, I'm excited, right? This is a good thing. Big data sounds great. I can think of all kinds of applications. Again, just to try to reinforce this, here are a few quotes. Information is the oil of the 21st century, and analytics is the combustion engine. Data is the new science, and big data holds the answers. And the last is from Hal Varian, the chief economist at Google. I keep saying that the sexy job in the next 10 years will be statisticians, and I'm not kidding. All right, so who goes to school and says, I can't wait to take a statistics class? But who goes to school and say, I can't wait to take a big data class? So that's why statisticians don't really think of themselves as statisticians. They think of themselves as data scientists and big data people. All right, so if you're not convinced yet, let me just give you a few quick examples of what's going on in business applications using big data. The way that the U.S. government traditionally goes back and looks at inflation rate is that they have a panel of consumers where they ask them to record every purchase that they make over a 2-week period of time. It's an incredibly laborious process. They actually come home at the end of the day. They fill out a diary and they make notes. They tally up these receipts. And then the Bureau of Labor Statistics compiles all that information together, and eventually it gets fed forward into what's called the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. And the question that you have to ask yourself, is this really the best way to do it? And the answer is no. Instead of going back and thinking about this on a monthly or a quarterly basis, we can do this on an instantaneous basis. This is a project that was started at MIT. It's called the Billion Prices Project. They have computers that are scanning 5 million items sold by 300 retailers in more than 70 countries, and they're taking all this price information to come back and create an online index of what prices look like. What you'll notice is that the online index nicely tracks the CPI. It's not the same, but it's going to track it. It's going to be fairly close. In fact, most people have been pointing out that they're starting to diverge. And the question is the CPI really capturing what's going on in inflation right now? Some people are saying that the big data is actually more accurate than the traditional CPI techniques. What's also interesting is if you follow Argentinian politics, Argentina doesn't want inflation. So the government has come back to their statisticians and said, we don't want inflation. So the statisticians do not report inflation anymore. This is the official index of prices in Argentina, according to the government. This line up here is what the big data solution looks like. And again, it's a very interesting story. But the point is that here, big data is perhaps not biased in the way that governments might want to try to manipulate what the inflation rate looks like. Here's another example of big data. Let's suppose you have a time series. In this case, I could have the initial unemployment claims on a weekly basis. You can go to correlates at Google. You can upload your file, and then Google will search through its database, and it'll look for other time series that match closely with your time series. Now, those time series that it's searching against are search keywords. So in this case, Google, without knowing anything about initial unemployment claims, which if you know anything in the U.S. government, this is really important because this is going to be a key leading indicator of what economic activity is going to look like. It turns out that it's highly correlated with the web search activity for filing for unemployment. So here, this blue line is the official initial unemployment data. The red line over here is the filing for unemployment. And what you notice is that it tracks really nicely. Not exactly. And we can go through and build statistical models to try to capture the divergence between the two. But the point here is that I might have a leading indicator, especially like as I look in 2008, there was a lot more searching for filing for unemployment before the actual numbers came out. Why look at searches? I could think about tweets. What happens when you're going to lose your job? Well, you might tweet to your friends, and your tweet might read something like, I just lost my job, who's buying my drinks tonight? It turns out that you can scan through and look for tweets that are related to jobs, and you can look for sentiment. You can use that to, again, predict what unemployment is going to look like. So the blue line, again, is the initial claims. This is on a shorter period than the last one, and then the red one are the predictions. The National Bureau of Economic Research and ASA have a survey of statisticians and econometricians to predict unemployment as well as other important economic time series. And this method actually improves by about 15% to 20% of the variance of the prediction error of the consensus forecast, which is a very hard thing to do. So again, big data is working. It's working well. Here's another one. This is one of my students that is working on this. The goal is to try to predict what TV ratings are going to look like. So this is the TV ratings for a popular TV show called Breaking Bad. So this is from 2011. The red line is the ratings. The yellow line are tweets that mention Breaking Bad. And then the green are the Google searches of Breaking Bad. So what you see are patterns. Most likely what you're interested in is what is the rating going to be before the show is actually given. So you can't see it as well, but what's happening here is there's some upturn in tweets and Google searches right before the showing, and then it starts to taper off. With the Google searches, it actually peaks after the show, not before the show. For tweets, it's almost instantaneous. It builds up. All right, so can you scan through? And the answer is yes. If you wanted to, you could try to predict what the ratings are going to be. I've been working on movies. You might be interested in trying to forecast what is the success of this movie going to be. Can I do it weeks in advance of when the movie is shown? If it's possible to do that, I could be much more efficient in allocating my promotional budgets. A movie might cost $100 million U.S. to make. It might cost $100 million to promote it. So you can see that there's a lot of money that's being spent. The last one is an illustration of understanding market structure. So we go to Edmunds.com, and we take a look at the blogs, the entries, the reviews. So this is talking about a Honda car, Civic versus Corolla. They have all kinds of things talking about their neon to their 16-year-old brother. I drove it about 130 miles today. Boy, does this put all those Civic versus Corolla back in perspective. The neon is very crudely designed and built. All right. So again, the person did not write this with the intent of giving an assessment or evaluation of the market structure. But if you scan through millions of these messages, you can look for common occurrences. It turns out that Honda Civic and Toyota Corolla are mentioned 2,762 times together. A Honda Civic and an Audi A6 are only mentioned 252 times together. So if things are mentioned more commonly, you'd expect that they're stronger competitors. So why don't we take this adjacency matrix, add a machine learning technique, and create a graph. This graph is illustrating that if the cars are close to one another, or the dots are close, then they're mentioned frequently, and we'd expect that they're going to be strong competitors, or stronger. So I have a BMW 7 Series, and I have a Jaguar S-Type over here. Over this way, I've got the Kia Optima, and the Kia Optima does not seem to be competing with the Lexus IS300, but the Acura does seem to be competing against the Lexus IS300. All right, so again, this roughly corresponds fairly well to what market structures look like. I could go on. There's all kinds of really exciting examples in terms of predicting book sales and movie sales and opinion polls and predicting elections and stock market performance, analyzing TV shows and movie and phone subscriptions and stock prices. I could go into industry, and companies are exploiting these. There are new companies that you've never heard of, like NIP, which is monitoring social media streams, so it allows its customers to parse through all kinds of social media streams in real time by keywords, trends, locations to look for patterns. I've got old companies like General Electric, GE, and they've come up with this idea of the industrial internet. Every device you have is going to have sensors, and those sensors are going to feed into some network. Right now, it's being used by airlines to predict mechanical malfunctions and reduce flight cancellations. So again, you all get this information, you scan for it, you look for these patterns. There's Kaggle, which is a do-it-yourself data scientist cash prize challenge. So it's like Netflix, where Netflix had the data challenge. They have a bunch of data. They don't know how to improve beyond what they've already done, so they say win $1 million if you can improve more than 10% or 20%. There's Ayasti, visualizing big data, generate 3D maps that unearth new trends in genetic traits of cancer survivors or track E. coli outbreaks. IBM has the Smarter Cities, where they're improving traffic flow by predicting points of congestion. There's the Weather Company. How does unique climate data in each location affect purchases? So I can see that anti-frizz shampoo sells really well in humid climates. Okay. So my hope is that you see that this is really exciting. The hype is well-founded, that we have a lot of information available to us that we didn't have before. So the advantages of big data is simply it's massive, it's immediate, it's timely, it's predictive, and it's free, or at least it's pretty inexpensive. There was an article a few years ago in Wired, and Wired went even further than that. They said it's the end of theory. What we're going to do is we're just going to look at big data, and we don't need to have theoretical models because all we have to do is look at the correlations and the patterns, and that's going to tell us what we need to know. The data analysis is going to create these incredibly accurate results. We have every single data point, so we don't really have to worry about sampling information. And it's really going to be passé to think about what causes one thing or another. We've got everything, and we'll be able to pick out the patterns. All right. So this is the hype, and this is the promise, and I think it's exciting. But I also think that there are some problems that are going to go along with this, and what I'd like to do is just try to simply illustrate a few problems to give you a sense of why we might need to be careful about big data. So the first relates to a project that I've started recently with a major bank in the United States. Basel II Accords have instructed banks that they need to assess what's the certainty that they have about the models that they're using. So what that means is that the OCC, the Federal Reserve Bank, have come back to each individual bank and said that you have to justify if you're going to use these really complex models, we want to make sure that you're thinking about the uncertainty that you have in using these models. That's a very different way of thinking about data mining. If you look at data mining, it's all about predictions. If I can come up with a better prediction, I'm happier. So that tends to be the gold standard that you're using for comparisons. In statistics, there's this idea that all models are wrong. This is a famous quote from George Box, a statistician, that said that all models are wrong. The practical question is, how wrong do they have to not be useful? All right. What's interesting is that you have these mandates by the Fed, but it turns out that no one really knows how to do it. At least I think I know how to do it. The way that I think you should do this is something using Bayesian data mining. So you don't want to go back and look at the data to pick out the model. What you need to start doing is thinking about the uncertainty that you have. The model itself is basically an expression, knowledge, and when you start ignoring that, if you just assume that you can figure out from the data, you're going to be led to some very strange answers, perhaps very incorrect answers. So again, just to try to give you an idea, let's suppose I go back and I have these observations. What might end up happening is I say, okay, I'm going to fit a model to those four observations. All right, so first of all, this is not massive. 4 points is not massive, but this is going to illustrate the point that I want to try to get across to you. it looks like a pretty good model, right? Well, the problem comes along when I want to start thinking about predicting outside of the range of the points that I've already seen. So this is something known as a Gaussian process, and the shaded area says that if I don't really know anything about the model beforehand, how confident can I be about what the relationship is between my input and my output? So that blue line is close at the points that I realize, but it's really far away when I start thinking about those areas that are not close to the data points that I realize. Now, why is this important? Well, for a bank, what they have to worry about is having enough assets and reserves. So if a loan is not paid back, that the bank is not going to go out of business. And that's what the Fed is concerned about. So after the last economic cycle, they had to bail out a bunch of banks, and they don't want that to happen again. So they want to increase the amount of assets that the bank has to hold. Banks don't want to increase their assets because that's money that they're not putting to use, where they're going to earn, generate returns from it. So banks want to keep as little as possible. All right, so we've got a statistical problem, a decision problem, and what I need to do is try to assess what's my certainty that I have. The traditional way of doing it is saying, okay, this is what the model is, and I don't think about the certainty that I have. And what I'm saying is that that gray area is the better thing to do because that reflects the uncertainty. So when I go through and start thinking about my decisions, I can integrate out the uncertainty that I have. All right, so here's another example. This is the U.S. residential mortgage delinquency rates starting in 1998. So we have prime and subprime, and we have fixed and variable rate, adjustable rate mortgages. So down at the bottom, we've got these prime fixed rate mortgages, and the delinquency rate is pretty low. It's like 2-3%, and it's very stable, right? That's the best loan to have in terms of what's the risk that's associated with it being paid back. So over here, what's really risky is going to be the subprime adjustable rate mortgages. And if I were to build my model between 1998 and 2000, this is the conclusions that I would reach. All right, so we can go through a much more extensive analysis, but the point that I'm going to make is, what do you think things are going to look like in 2000 to 2002? What's going to happen is that the story is going to start to change. Now I'm going to see that the subprime adjustable rate mortgages are actually performing a little better than the subprime fixed rate mortgages. And all of a sudden, I've noticed that my really stable loans have a delinquency rate that's gone up an extra percentage. What happens in the next period? And by the way, I should point out that this is shaded area. This is a downturn, an economic cycle. Now, what happens is things start getting better again in 2002 to 2005. If I were to run my model in this period, I'd come up with a much different conclusion. If I go back and now look at the period from 2005 to 2007, I start seeing something very different. I get this explosion in delinquency rates. Still, the prime fixed rate mortgages are fairly stable. So if I'm thinking about doing some kind of data mining, I'm going to pick up these patterns and I'm going to start forecasting out what I think the delinquency rates are going to be under the assumption that what the future is going to look like is what the past has looked like. And that's a poor assumption to make. What's going to happen is through 2008 and 2009, we're going to be way over. Instead of being down 2-3%, we're going to be like 6-7% for our stalwart mortgages, and we're going to be nearly 30% for subprime adjustable rate mortgages, which really hurts. And then I go back and I take a look at this new period, and I'm actually stable at these really high rates. All right, so this is what the pattern looks like. Most companies do not have 10, 20 years of data, right? What company out there has 100 years of mortgage data that it can rely upon? How many business cycles have we had in the last decade? Two, right? I mean, that's not a lot of empirical data. If you're going to go back and ask questions about how do these loans perform as I see contractions and expansions in the economy. All right. So again, our challenge is that we make all kinds of assumptions about these models, and typically we create a model. So in this case, there's some property, maybe delinquency rates, theta, and I want to try to predict what the theta is going to be. I typically will go back and condition on some model, and I predict what that theta is going to be. It turns out that that's going to give me a biased estimate, and it's also going to mean that I'm going to be overconfident. If I start thinking about what's the confidence, what's the variability in this theta, if I condition on the model, I am going to be overconfident. The true variance is going to be much higher than that. Again, we can break it out. The intuition is that data mining often leads to overconfidence. So Bayesian data mining techniques allow us to incorporate our uncertainty. So instead of making these overconfidence, we can try to build the confidence or the lack of confidence that we have into the model. So instead of just trying to pick everything up from the data, the point is that you need to have some other information. All right, so how do we compensate? Well, we have functional forms that we're trying to learn. There's errors that are correlated. Most of the time, you assume that errors are uncorrelated. Well, that's a bad idea. In a downturn in the economy, many people are going to lose their jobs, and they all lose their jobs at once. Let's suppose a typhoon comes through and it starts hitting houses. Does it randomly hit houses? And the answer is no, it hits them in clusters. So the error in one house is going to be correlated with the error in another. And again, relationships are not stable through time. So let's go to my second example. My second example is retail price optimization. And I talk about this in lots of different contexts because I do this all the time. What we've seen is that in CRM, the optimization of price has probably been the most impactful area in the last 10 years. It's estimated that gross margins range between 2 to 8%, and retailers typically have gross margins of about 25%. So to have an increase due to using these price optimization and data mining techniques of 2 to 8%, that's a huge impact on the overall profitability of a retailer. So this is exciting stuff. Here's an example that I give where I've got the data for just one product in a grocery store. You're looking at weekly sales for one store. And again, just multiply this out times tens of thousands of products for dozens or hundreds of stores. The red line at the top is price. The blue line at the bottom is sales. So what you see is that the price per carton of orange juice is somewhere between $2 and $3. When it's at $3, sales tends to be low. When prices drop at $2, you notice that sales spike up. So here's one particularly aggressive promotion where the price went from $3 down to $1.50. So it was a buy one, get one free. What happens is sales jump up. Now, it's easier to look at it in this scatter plot here. So I can fit a regression line and I can optimize my profitability by looking at different prices and trying to figure out what is the price that is going to maximize my profits. Again, I can figure this out. There's all kinds of econometric techniques. I realize that one product is not sold in isolation. There are lots of products that are being sold. So if I start changing the price of one product, it's going to affect the sales of all the other products in the store. So this is an example of an optimal product line pricing problem. So as I change the price of one product and the price of the other product, I notice that the total profits are going to change. So if I push the price of Tropicana up, what happens? Well, people start buying Minute Maid. Or if I price the push Minute Maid prices up, people switch over to Tropicana. So as a retailer, I want to try to maximize my profits, so I need to jointly consider all those prices at the same time. This is what I would like to see. This is what I actually see. This is an example of where I've gone back and I've estimated what the category profit looks like from the data that I see. And it's not bad. If I look at this, what it's saying is that I should sell the one product at a very high price and the other at a low price or a normal price. What's happening in this model is that it is going back and saying that as you raise the price, people start substituting towards those other products. So the model doesn't really have a good sense of reason. You can go from a $10 carton of orange juice and use the model to predict what happens when it goes to $100 or $1,000. I don't know about your grocery store, but I've never saw a carton of orange juice that's going to cost $1,000 or $10,000 or $100,000. Yet this model says that that's the optimal thing to do. So models come up with really bad predictions when you start pushing them out of range. Models are good when you're looking at things that are in the range of the data that you've seen, but as soon as you start pushing it outside. All right, so what's the solution of this data mining problem? Well, the solution is something that's known as business rules. And what people usually do with business rules is they start elaborating, saying, well, the prices can't go out of this range. It doesn't make any sense. So the price should always be within 20% of our competitors. The difference between the store brand and the national brand shouldn't be more than 20%. All right, so they elaborate thousands of rules. In fact, if you take a look at some systems, the systems themselves manage all these rules and they get a really complex optimization problem. So you do the data mining. After you do the data mining, then you do the optimization and then you throw in all these rules. Well, the problem is that's not an efficient way to do data mining. It's not an efficient way to make decisions. All those rules that you have are trying to say something about what you think the relationship is between prices and sales. So to improve the pricing solution, what we want to do is start bringing these constraints in, and we'll do a much better job. In interest of time, I won't spend a lot of time on this. This is just illustrating one of the leading companies that are doing this rule-based pricing. This just illustrates, if I go through a traditional data mining technique, it tells me that I should be pricing somewhere around $1.50. However, if I look at this, I notice that there's a really high chance over here that I should be pricing near $2. So when you calculate this out, either you choose the $2 or you're going to choose something in between those. And it just doesn't do well. When you do it with the rules and you use the rules beforehand, you get a much better answer. And again, it's located where you think it should be. So the point is that we have information, and it's not a pure data mining exercise. We have economic theory, we have business intuition, we have managerial intuition. We want to use that as much as possible. So instead of thinking about this as being brought in after the fact, it's much better to bring it in beforehand when you're training the models. So the models don't just look at the data. You give them the theory, you give them the data, and then they bring it all together at the same time. All right, so here's my last example. And again, this is a famous one. It goes back to 2008. Google created this system called Google Flu Trends. So remember, Google does no evil, right? So in fact, they try to do good. And one of the good things that they tried to do was to predict what are the instances of flu. So again, how is it usually done? Well, the CDC has a survey. They get information from hospitals about cases that have been reported. governments take a long time to collect information. They have a way of transmitting the information, the channel, and they get it faxed or they get emails and they collate all this stuff together. It takes the CDC roughly 2 weeks to tell you that there's been an outbreak. Again, it's better than that, but on average, you know, it's like a 2-week delay. So what Google said was, well, we should be able to do better than that. We have the series, we have these Google correlates, so let's feed in the CDC's knowledge about flu cases, and let's try to find out what are some keywords that are going to be indicators. So what they found out was that when people are searching for a set of roughly 40 or 45 queries that are symptoms of the flu, or people searching for flu-related search terms, if I take all those things together, I can build a really good forecasting model of what the flu looks like. So what's the problem with that? Well, there's no problem. And this is great. This is exactly what we want. In fact, the CDC said the earlier the warning, the earlier prevention and control measures can be put in place, this could prevent cases of influenza. Again, there's still roughly 36,000 deaths from influenza. So if we could prevent some deaths, this is a great thing. Well, in the last year, if you were watching the news in the 2012 and the 2013 cycle for the flu, Google predicted that there was going to be a huge outbreak. In fact, Google was predicting like double what the CDC was saying. So this is an analysis that was done. It came out in Science just earlier this year. If you're interested, you can go back and look at this in more depth. But the essence, the answer that they came up with was that Google is changing the way that people are searching. They change their search engine all the time. The last instance of the search engine Hummingbird actually became much better, much more intelligent. So now if I go to Google, I can ask it questions and Google actually gives me answers back. Well, one of the things that Google did during that time period is that they have the automatic completion. So you go to Google and you type something like, do I have flu, flash, flat feet, fleas. So it automatically completes it. So what was happening is that the automatic completion was actually leading to a larger number of people searching for flu-related symptoms. So it wasn't that people were searching for it, it's just that Google was redirecting them and Google miscounted. All right, so the conclusion is that Google Flu Trends was like the bathroom scale where the spring slowly loosens up and no one ever recalibrated it. This is from David Laser, who was the author of the study. And again, the point is that Google is constantly making tweaks, so the lesson is that the underlying patterns within social media, they change. People's online behavior changes. The way that I use the web today is different than the way I used the web 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago. I wasn't using the web 20 years ago. Well, I was, but that was Gopher, and no one called it the web. So we need to recalibrate their accuracy. All right, so what have we learned? Well, we've learned that big data is great. I can answer all kinds of problems with it, and we should be really excited about it, but we also see that there are some serious limitations. The promise of big data is that it can solve problems faster, cheaper, better, but the problem with big data is that it even though it's data, even though it's big data, it's still data, and data has biases. The past is not necessarily representative of the future. I've got to be very careful when I go back and project out how things are going to change. Participants in social media are not necessarily representative of overall society. There's a nice app that's come out recently in Boston where they're using smartphones as people drive along to look at how the car jostles. Right? They're looking for potholes. You don't have potholes. Boston has potholes, right? Chicago, Pittsburgh, we have potholes because you constantly have the freezing and thawing cycles and our roads get these big potholes. All right, so what's happening is you've got millions of people driving around, logging all these hours, and you can record all these potholes. So I can now have a complete map of all the potholes in Boston. Doesn't that sound great? Well, the problem is that not everyone has a smartphone. So basically what I'm mapping out are the more affluent individuals that are carrying their smartphones. I can see where their potholes are, but if I'm going to the poorer neighborhoods that are less traveled or have fewer smartphones, I'm not getting that kind of information. So again, it's biased. If I go back to Porsche, there was a famous example when they brought out the Cayenne, the SUV. No one on the Porsche website, Renlist, wanted this SUV. It's like they thought this was awful. This is going to be soccer moms, football moms that are going to now have Porsches, and this shouldn't happen. So if you looked online, you would have said, this is awful. There's no way that Porsche is going to succeed. They're going to tank themselves. What happened is that they had the most successful launch ever in their history of a new car. Because they realized that the people that were on those lists were not representative of the people that were going to be buying the car. All right, so things change through time, and you need to start reflecting that change. Knowledge, either managerial or theoretical, is still going to be useful, and again, this is going to be important. So the disadvantages of big data is that it's not representative. The people that are writing reviews tend to be the people that are really excited or really disappointed. Data quality may be poor. We've got privacy and confidentiality issues. It's difficult to assess the accuracy and certainty, and the past may not be representative of the future. All right, so the lesson is that I think big data is really exciting. I think it's worthwhile, this hype that's going on. It is a rich source of information. There are a lot of really difficult challenges, theoretically and business, of trying to take this unstructured, massive data sets and be able to do something new with them. However, you need to integrate economic and managerial knowledge. You need to be aware of biases in the data, and you need to understand the difference between correlation and causations. All right, so I'm out of time, so I'll just stop here, but I will open it up for questions if you'd like to ask me a few questions.